There are so many women out there that are taking a stand against gender inequality and are paving the way for the future generation. Ordinary women that are creating a more inclusive and powerful society, free from stereotypes, racism and sexism. And I'm here to share their stories with all of you. Stay tuned, because this is WEN Power, your source of inspiring, powerful and positive stories. And I'm here to discover how we can change the narrative, one story at a time. I am your host, Ilaria Biancacci, journalist and founder of WEN Power.
Hello and welcome to this new episode of WEN Power podcast. I'm here today with an incredible and fearless woman. I'm really, really happy to have her here with me. And her name is Dani Wallace. She's the leader of the Queen Beef movement and a creator of the Fly Anyway Foundation. What Dani does, she helps people to show up, wise up and raise. And regardless of your journeys, you need to remember that you can. So welcome, Dani, and thank you. Thank you so much for being here today.
I am so happy to be here. I'm so excited to speak to you.
How crazy is that? We were just saying that, you know, we met briefly 3 weeks ago at the Ideas Fest. Time fly away. And now we're sitting here recording this incredible episode of the podcast. And I'm so, so happy.
Right? It feels like we were just saying, it feels like 5 minutes ago and a lifetime ago all at once. I think when you experience something like going to a really cool event where lots of really cool people are there, you meet people and everyone's shooting from the hip and it feels really crackly with energy. You spend time directly after that sort of following up with everybody that you realize just how many people you met. But I was so glad to meet you. And when you invited me onto the podcast, I was like, girl, I am there.
Oh my God, this is like, I don't know. It's like I'm speaking to you for, and I know you already for ages, you know. This is great. So I'm going to take you straight away diving into this interview. And I want to ask you a question that I ask to all my guests. And is what is it that you're fighting for?
What is it that I'm fighting for? It's really interesting that you asked that particular question, because I've got two hats that I wear. One is that I'm a speaking coach. So I help people who've got businesses share their business and mission message so they can have more influence, more impact, generate more income. That's like my, almost like my muggle business, even though it's completely not a muggle business. It's a complete unicorn of a business. But also I have a sort of a social impact arm of that. And that's the Fly Anyway Foundation. That's a CIC that I've created that helps people who've experienced domestic abuse plug into business goods and services. And the one of the things that I say to a lot of my speaking clients is, imagine if you're speaking about what it is that you do, imagine that you're Buddha CEO, you're like heading on into battle. What's the battle that you're trying to win? You know, you've got your army behind you and we're going to go into battle. And there's two things that I am in the fight for. One is for people from all kinds of marginalized communities to take up space. I think particularly within the business space where I work and live and thrive, that there is still a lot of inherent misogyny. There's lots of racism. There's lots of homophobia. And for me to try and reach as many different people as possible and help empower them to take up space is definitely one of the big fights that I am sort of heading on into battling. And then the other is that something I experienced from a really young age was generational domestic abuse. So I grew up in the UK, in the northwest of the UK, on what we call the council estates, like in the US, if anyone's listening in the US, like the projects. It's where the, you know, the local government will fund social housing and what have you. It's a relatively poor area. And what happens notoriously is that people that are in struggle will often find themselves more at risk of domestic abuse, domestic violence, coercive control, addiction. And they were really the blueprint. That was the blueprint for how I grew up. So, and that informed a lot of the decisions that I made in my intimate partner relationships as I got older. So I felt like all through my life, I was trying to escape that. But because of the blueprint that I had, the information that I had, the role models that I had, I kept making poor decisions. I kept coming back to this sort of cyclical behavior of domestic abuse or toxic relationships in my intimate partner relationships, friendships at work. And so I decided that if ever I was to make it successful for myself, if ever I was to make a success for my life and create safety for myself, that I would make it my life's work to help people who've experienced domestic abuse fly anyway. There's this quote from the B movie. I don't know if you've ever seen the B movie,
but not yet.
Oh, you've got to. It's so good. But there's this quote at the beginning, and it goes, aerodynamically, bees shouldn't be able to fly. Their little wings shouldn't get their fat little bodies off the ground. And the bees don't care what humans think is impossible. The bee flies anyway. And that is that's the real fight that I'm fighting, is to help as many people as possible take up space. And regardless of any adversity that they've experienced, they get to choose. And yes, it's a choice to fly anyway.
This is really beautiful, and I totally agree with you with what you say, that, you know, you're trying to make it easier for diverse people to earn some space, which is, from the media and journalistic perspective, is what is happening on WEMPOWER, where I'm trying to do, because, you know, otherwise we will never be able to see something different or something right. That we can relate to. And that brings me also back to the blueprint idea. You know, if you don't see something represented, you think you cannot achieve it and you cannot escape. So really, really beautiful what you just shared. And actually, I think it's a really important fight that,
yeah,
regardless, you know, from the space we operate, the environment, everyone should always, you know, keep this close to their heart, you know, to try to make space for people that normally don't have space, and try to break some patterns so that there are more opportunities for others to follow. So
that's right. Otherwise, we're in echo chambers. We're just exactly. In echo chambers, and we don't see outside of that. So in one respect, we might think things. I'm finding this quite a bit on LinkedIn, but I'm quite new to LinkedIn. And I've built a lot of my audience on Facebook and on Instagram, and I've really curated my circle and my audience there. And it's a beautiful place to be, and a really inclusive place to be, but also quite protected then, because being challenged, my audience understand that there is inherent misogyny, and there's sexism, and there's racism, and we kind of come together to share our best practices with each other. And it's really easy to think that when you own and not own but facilitate an inclusive environment, that there are, you know, every other environment's like that, and that is not the case. Like, it happens to be that we're in this echo chamber of loveliness, but actually I'm peeping around the curtain at LinkedIn, and I'm seeing, you know, the thing that we're all frightened of in embodied, like showing itself and really rearing its ugly head. And there is so much work to be done to get outside of our echo chambers and allow ourselves to sit on the spikes and share this, you know, that we need to be forward thinking, that we need to be sharing our experience, that our lived experience isn't the only one, that there are lots of other lived experiences. And the more that we share those, and historically, we're like tribal animals. The way that we passed information to each other over generations was through talking, through storytelling, through sharing experiences. And we've almost kind of lost the art of that. And we're just telling our story and not listening. And there needs to be more listening.
I completely agree. I really agree. I mean, you touch a very close topic to my heart. I mean, as a journalist, storytelling is everything. And when I decided I wanted to become a journalist, I was very young, and the industry changed and evolved so much. And I'm not the same person as I was 5 minutes ago, 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, as, you know, our collective experience is not the same. So it's really important that we find a way to actually give voice to all the stories, but do it, you know, with respect, with space, with the right words, and making people feel safe.
And the intention as well, right? It's getting that intention right. It's not a case of just standing on the hill and shouting about what you think is right. It's about welcoming people to the conversation. I went to see, I don't know if you heard the comedian Tim Minchin. He's a musical comedian. And I went to go and see one of his shows. And he's quite political, very, very sort of left in terms of his politics. But the way that he was explaining this really resonated with me, is, and this happens a lot on social media and out in wider journalism, is that often people will go around trying to hit people with the right stick. Like, I am very right, and I'm going to tell you how right I am. And that actually distances, it disallows people from entering into conversations because they become fearful. You know, oh, well, you know, I might disagree with you on something. So how do we safely disagree? How do we allow ourselves to have conversations where we don't agree? Or how do we invite each other along to each other's parties? I think it's so juicy for me. That is so interesting for me.
It is. I mean, we can speak about this for the rest of the evening, because I can see that we do share some, like, I knew it already from the first moment I saw you, but I'm discovering even more that we're really flowing with the same vibe. And it's really important that we keep reminding ourselves as business owners as well and entrepreneurs that we need to keep this values alive in everything we do, because otherwise it's just a business that is making money, not making any change and not actually bringing anything to this planet. So really important to remember. You already mentioned that my second question was about why the bee, but we have a very interesting movie recommendation. So if none of you also watch it, now we know why we have to. So we discover a little bit more as well about the reason why is the queen bee and why is the bee your symbol.
So it's not just because of the Bee movie. I mean, the Bee movie lent itself beautifully to, particularly that quote, lent itself beautifully to what I was experiencing at the time. How did I articulate what I wanted to do with my life and, you know, my legacy work and the values of my business? But actually, bees do some really cool things. So they do, I mean, there's a lot of talk, especially in sustainability conversations and, you know, economic conversations and climate change conversations, that bees are really pivotal. Like, I'm here for that. But they also have some really cool behavioral traits that lend itself, I think, to what makes great community and what makes great business community. So one of the first things that they do is they do it's called the waggle dance. So they're like buzzing around, trying to find, like, leave the hive, like the worker bees, and they go buzzing around trying to find the patches of flowers that have got the good nectar in, right? That haven't been used up, that haven't been overused. And what they do, they go buzzing around, they find these patches of flowers or these patches of vegetation or whatever it is that they're getting the nectar from. They then go back to the hive, and via means of dance, no less, which speaks to my heart, because I love having a boogie, as do you, so I found out.
Apparently, if anyone wants to see me dancing, you need to go to Dani's Instagram page and watch the reel. I'm carrying a guitar and it's a silent disco, but oh my God, just
go. Girl, you're living your best life. And by means of dance, the bee shares with the rest of the community where the good stuff is. Doesn't keep it to itself. And then as a community, they don't overfarm it. They check in with each other and they check in with, like, sort of natural depletion and replenishment opportunities. And then they stop when enough is enough and not 1 second after. And then they'll move on. But I love that they have this sort of communication via dance where here's where the good stuff is, everybody. Like, come on over here. Instead of, you know, this really archaic patriarchal way of thinking, which is this, you know, oh, we've got the good stuff over here, we're going to keep it, don't tell anybody, we're going to keep it to ourselves and keep all this good stuff to ourselves. Where the thing that I found about business, the thing that I found about success, about money, is that actually, if you've got the right education, the right community, the right network, tenacity, resilience, that there is enough for everybody. There is more than enough. There is a surplus for everybody. And as much as we can, it's our job that if we know better, we get to help people to do better, each one teach one, right? So we get to do the waggle dance. And that's a lot of the work that I do within my events, a lot of the work that I do with on my social media. It's all about the waggle dance. It's about sharing that really good, that here's where the success is. Here's the good things. Here are the good people. Go and follow these people. And they also do this thing, which is brilliant. When they're building something new, the bees who have got more experience will link arms, like actually link arms. They lace arms together and show the newer bees where to build to. So when they're building a hive or building like new structures, their bees that have sort of done the building before will show the other bees what to do. It's called festooning. So when they're building, the bees will festoon, they will link arms together and show the new bees where to build. And there's loads of these lovely analogies that we can draw from bee behavior. So you can see like the queen bee, the actual phrase the queen bee has nothing to do with me saying, oh, I'm better than everybody else, follow me, I am, you know, I am the one to watch. It's actually a reclamation statement that if me, from where I come from a poor background, from poor relationships, I'm able to make a success of myself, you can too. If I can audaciously enter a room and say, hey, my name's Danny Wallace and I am the queen bee, you can look over and say, flipping heck, if she can do it, I can too. Or the king bee, or the royal bee, however you identify. But the phrase, I am the queen bee, it's a reclamation statement, your birthright to success, to health, to wealth, to good times and good people and good experiences and good sex and all of the good things in life. We get to reclaim that for ourselves, and not just the queen who was born the queen, who also did not get a say in the matter.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, this really resonates with me a lot because I'm not a bee expert, but also, you know, this very predominant female aspect in the bee communities. I think it also, this is the reason perhaps as well, it really resonated with you and you find a way to make it a symbol of your fight and of your, you know, the work you do, because it's really beautiful what you just shared. And it's, again, the importance of having a community and, you know, when you are an entrepreneur as well, sometimes, most of the time you feel very lonely. People will not understand you. Yeah. You cannot speak with your family and friends because they might not really get that business talk you want to do.
My mom still doesn't know.
My mom, she's like, what is that you're doing? You know, something like that. But it's important, the sharing part of it, because if we keep everything for ourselves, then, you know, what again, what's the good in that?
The enjoyment in it, yeah, as well? Like if one of the things that I love about building the community in the way that I have, in building the businesses in the way that I have, is that I get to share it with people, and not just share my success, but share theirs. So you kind of like what you're doing here with this podcast is that you're raising up the people that you found in your life, in your travels, who you find inspiring, you're sharing them with other people. You're waggle dancing right now is exactly what you're doing. I do it. I love that you're giving it a little boogie. For anyone that's just listening and that can't see, Alaria is giving it some moves right now. We are like having a little waggle dance together. But that's exactly what we're doing. We're sharing the good stuff. We're helping people expand their networks. And when we do that, we get to enjoy it together. You and I met in a place where we were enjoying ourselves as well as learning. And how good's that? Like, how is that amazing work?
I mean, that was the perfect environment for things like this to happen, you know. And it's so true. It's so true. Sharing is caring always. So right, if we don't recognize that, what's the pressure? We're going to end up alone with all our money and our business. But, you know, what's the price?
Just counting our shekels like Scrooge McDuck. No, thanks. I'm all right for it.
Exactly. And let's go back a little bit to your personal experience and life and the way that it shaped you to then bring to life the Queen Bee movement. So you mentioned before you grew up on the council, and I read you grew up in Preston. So how was the experience there, and how did you manifest this new chapter of your life, you know, coming as well from a history of domestic abuse and, you know, being a single mom, you experienced homeless as well. So very, very important and painful experience for a woman. But then here you are today with this amazing business, this, like, I don't know, extraordinary energy. And I can't stop smiling since we started this call. So tell me how and what did you do to get to where you are now and, you know, to make these things happen? So someone else that might listen to this podcast might think, hey, Danny made it, so can I.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because people like us, people like me, didn't go on. So I was very, very lucky that when I was growing up, I was the youngest of lots of cousins, and there was only my sister and I that were part of the family unit. But because my mum was a very caring, or I say, well, she is, she's very much alive and well and with us. She was a very caring person. And although we were struggling in terms of, my mum and dad would argue there was a lot of drink that was involved in sort of my growing up. Actually, we were the safest house out of all of the houses of the aunties and the uncles. So a lot of the cousins came to live with us, and we were like a revolving door. It was like we were the foster house. And when you're the youngest in a very noisy situation, you often have to be noisy in order to be heard, right? I would really seek validation. I was very much the youngest child. So I would seek validation from outside of myself. I didn't get validation from myself. I needed to be told, you know, I was doing a good job, or that people were proud of me. And one of the ways that I managed to elicit that very early on was through singing. So I found, or actually my primary school teacher found, that I was really good at singing. I must have been about 7 or 8 years old. And they knew that things were quite difficult at home, but got in touch with my mum and said, look, Daniela can sing. I'd really like to support her. And my mum said, I'm really sorry, but she can't have any singing lessons. We can't afford them. Which at the time was very much the case, that singing lessons, to this day, they're really quite expensive if you have nothing. Yeah. And singing is a bit of a superfluous requirement. Like if it was, oh, Danny's really exceeding at maths, she could maybe do her exams earlier. Maybe they'd have found a way. But this is singing. Like people like us don't go on to be singers. Mm. And so this primary school teacher said, well, do you know what? If you just give me something nominal, like maybe £1.50 or £2 for a lesson every week, and I'll see her through, we'll get her some grades and we'll get her through music exams and what have you. And that's what she did. She was so kind. Her name was Elaine Sutton. I'll never forget her. She just showed us this kindness, and mum didn't want to accept anything for free, didn't want to accept charity, but then couldn't afford me to have professional training. So I didn't have any professional training. And when I was 11, this teacher called me and she went, look, Danny, I can't teach you anymore. There's nothing at my level that I have that I'm able to teach you. So that was all the training that I had. And then it was the rise of the reality TV situation. So we're talking right back at the beginning of like pop stars and pop idol. And that was just in the UK before it kind of got franchised out to the USA and what have you. My family kind of started to pin their hopes on me to become famous, because I wasn't going to go to university. I was, even though I was incredibly intelligent at school, I wasn't built for academia. I was too disruptive. I didn't want to sit there and learn. My neurodivergent brain didn't want to sit and be academic, and I wanted to learn by doing. But my family started to kind of pin their hopes on me as a, I was going to make it. I was going to be famous with this voice now. I'm going to enter these auditions and these reality TV. And I never got anywhere because I was never allowed to share my story. And a lot of these are story based. So I ended up working on cruise ships. So I would sing all over the world. I was singing in hotel resorts. I was singing, if anyone is watching from the UK, there's like two rival holiday camps. Well, not rivals, but competitive holiday camps. I was Butlins, where he was a red coat, and Pontins, where he's a blue coat. So I was a Pontins blue coat for a little while in sunny Southport. And what that allowed me to do was allow me to really cut my teeth from a presentation perspective. So I was able to sing and dance and understand showmanship. And really, that was my university. That was where I learned how to be a performer, how to compare, how to share with audiences. And I didn't have to pay for it. They paid me. I mean, they made me work all the hours under the sun, but still, I got paid to do that learning. So eventually, that wasn't a proper job. And that was the next thing for me, was that if I'm never going to make it famous, I better get a proper job. You're a bright girl, Danny. You need some sort of roots putting down. Mm-hmm. So I came back to the UK and I got a job at the rise of the contact center. So we're talking sort of 2005, 2006, when contact centers were the new factories. So if we think about the industrial age, the 70s, the 80s, mid 90s, factories were a huge, huge employer. And into the mid 90s and on into the noughties and the 10s, call centers became the place where that employed huge amounts of people. And that's where I began to work in the corporate sector. And because of my ability to perform there, I started working for the Carphone Warehouse at the time, when the Carphone Warehouse were really in boom. And they talent managed me through their talent management process. And I ended up working in learning and development. So I swapped a stage for a stage. So instead of singing on stage and comparing, I was hosting training events. They were putting me through my university furthermore, teaching people how to teach. So training the trainer, learning how to personality profile, learning different presentation styles, learning different communication styles. So it was, I had like the university of life through my corporate world, all the way through this. My intimate partner relationships were just askew. So I had a really good proper job on the top. And then actually my personal life, I hadn't had any of that sort of validation, or, you know, I was seeking love in the wrong places. And I was, you know, my attachment styles were a bit askew because of how I was informed when I was growing up. So I had this, all of this great corporate situation going on. And then underneath, things were really quite dire. So much so I was in the relationship. I was in a relationship with my second daughter's biological dad, and that became a really dangerous situation for the both of us in the end, where it was very violent, it was coercive, there was a lot of financial abuse that was going on, and so much so that we had to have the courts sort of separate us. I had to get an injunction in place to start accessing services. What that actually meant was that the house that I'd managed to buy, and I was feeling successful because no one else in my sort of peer group had been able to buy a house. It was only a tiny little house, but we had to let it go. I was not able to afford it anymore. And I was in financial ruin because of the situation I found myself in. And very soon after that, with my two children under the age of three, we were homeless. We were sofa surfing. And there was this point where I was sort of sat in the car about to head down to London. My kids were staying with my mum for a couple of nights. So we would stay between my mum's and my sisters and friends. And it was like this scene out of a really bad 80s movie where it's raining outside. There's a sad song playing on the radio and I'm crying. But I really didn't know if I'd just kissed my kids goodbye or goodnight, because I didn't feel like I could make a good decision. For all of the veneer of this corporate situation that I was in, actually underneath, I didn't feel like I was adding any value to the world. I didn't feel like I was giving my kids anything stable. The only thing that I could do was lose my house so that I could get tax credits, so that I could keep them in full-time nursery, so that I could work. And everything was about keeping them in full-time childcare so that I could work. And I was just so lost. And I vowed, you know, if ever I get out of this mess, then I'll make it my life's work to help as many people out as possible, to reach that hand behind me and help where I can.
It's really empowering to listen your story. I have a completely different experience, so perhaps I don't relate for many aspects, but hearing you speaking, because I read your story before coming, preparing myself for this interview, but you know, one thing is you read it and one thing is actually I hear it from you, and all I can see is just like an incredible power and a strength that you have, like, you know, you build up a better future for you and for your kids as well, and it's, and for many other women and people that you're helping with your business, with your passion and talent. So this is really inspiring for me, and I don't know what else
My back was against the wall. Like I didn't know if I was driving my car off into the sunset or around a lamppost, and it was that stark of a, I don't know if I should end it all. I don't know if that's where I'm at. And there was this fight to survival. There's a meme knocking around on the internet talking about, you know, you're not weak for sharing your rock bottom moments. You're not weak for crying on the floor. You're not weak for asking for help. That's you with a stick trying to fight your way through a jungle full of snakes, full of the most poisonous spiders, saying, look, just somebody give me a stick. I'll give me a stick and I'll fight my way out. And I was at the kind of at that point, whereas I just needed a stick. And that's, I decided that either life was going to happen to me or I was going to happen to life. Yeah. And the very first step to recovery from that was asking for help, was asking for the stick, was stop trying to be so ashamed. I was so ashamed. I'm an intelligent, articulate person. I've got a really good job. My kids are beautiful, kind, incredible little beings. Like, how could I get something so right and get things so wrong at the same time? And I was so ashamed. But at that point, I was like, someone give me a stick. I'm ready. Like, I've got fight in me. Just someone give me a stick. And that's where that came from. And then from there, everything has been about tenacity. Everything's been about, okay, well, now I'm grateful to be alive, because in that moment, I nearly died. At that moment, I decided that I wasn't going to die. And at that moment, I suddenly became really powerful, because I'd lost everything, and I decided that it wasn't going to happen to me anymore, that I was going to happen to it. And that's the force, I think, with which people meet me now. They don't see me on the back foot with myself, and they think that it's all this magically, suddenly one day I started shitting glitter. And that isn't the case at all. Mm-hmm. Like, I asked for a stick and I started fighting. And from there on in, as long as it remained within my value set, which was kindness, above all else kindness, and above all else community, and within the spirit of help, that's how I was going to build the rest of my life.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, you touch a part, and I think it's related with, like you say, ask for help, but it's also show your vulnerability. That sometimes, you know, we think that because if we're going to show people how vulnerable we are, we mean less, our work right. is not worth it, you know. And actually, I think it's one of the bigger strengths, especially when it comes to leaders or to people that disruptors or people creative like us, or that, you know, it's really important to find the courage to say, okay, right now I need help, because otherwise it's a very lonely tunnel, you know, point. Yeah. And it's
you'll trip yourself up, because you only know what you know. And if that's brought you so far, you're not going to go any further, because you don't know any better. You know, I talk about showing up, wising up, and rising up. It's like, it's the formula that I live my life by. It's the mantra that I live my life by, that if I've got this area that I want to rise up in, then I'm missing two aspects. If I'm not there already, then I'm missing two things. One, I need to wise up. I need to learn what I need to know in order to get there. And then the next thing, I need to show up for it. I need to take that intentional action. So many people talk about, oh, we're going to manifest, you know, £1 million. Or great, good, have the intentions, but you have to show up for it, and you need to learn. And you can only learn when you ask or when you seek. And I think for now, more than ever, this tenacity and this acceptance of vulnerability, if we cast aside our need to be correct, then actually we give ourselves more scope to grow. So I work within my team and within my community, with everything that I do, with this completely like openness about, I might get this wrong. But if I get it wrong, then I'm going to figure it out, and we're going to solution seek. And I think that if we sit within this need to be right, and it's a safety thing, like when it comes to being right, it keeps us alive. The limbic bit of our brains that are still animal, consider that if we are wrong, we are at mortal peril. Now, that's not the case anymore. So if we get things wrong, what we're going to do? What's the worst that's going to happen? And then once we understand what the worst is going to happen, we're able to solution seek from there. And I think it's that quality in a leader now more than ever is necessary, is the ability to, I mean, look at our government, for example. We need people with the ability to put their hands up and say, hey, we got this wrong, but here's what we're going to do to make it right. Or we're open to listening, and we're open to help, we're open to collaboration in order to make things better. And if we see that more, I think that then we can come together more as a wider community.
I completely agree. And also, if you think about, we're still living in the aftermath of COVID.
Yep.
And if there is one thing that COVID should teach us, it's, you know, that together we stay stronger and we make things happen. So if we take ourselves, you know, you mentioned this before, like, the sense of tribal community, you know, the strength is there, because alone, if each one of us would be alone, then we would not actually make a change or make something happen in the world. And with all the crisis that we need to manage right now, I think it's, like you said, it's really, really important that, you know, from the top down, from governments to local communities, to schools, to employees, everyone is like, okay, we're doing this wrong. What should we do to make it better?
Now's the time to be festooning, right? Now's the time to be linking arms.
Totally.
I'm always here for a B analogy.
I like that. So one question I wanted to ask you is, if because we share already a lot, but specifically, if you want to share an advice with all the women and young women that are listening to this podcast, they might be student, employed, entrepreneur, both, no, anything of this, what would that be?
People come to me specifically in the work that I do seeking confidence, right? And seeking the confidence to seize opportunities, or seeking the confidence to enter a room. And I think that confidence is a fallacy. I think confidence is this magical thing that we think happens to us one day. You know, like I said to you earlier on, I didn't wake up and start shitting glitter. That's not what happened. Confidence is knowing. And I think that what we have done as a gender, particularly women, in fact, anybody that's othered, is that we have lost this inherent knowing, this intuition, this listening to ourselves. If we start to tap into that more and start to listen to our gut, and when something feels wrong, allow ourselves to take decisive action at that point, that can prevent us from feeling so much more pain so much later on. And this can apply to whether you are in a relationship, whether you are in an employment, whether you are in an educational establishment, whether you have a business, whether you have a friendship. If something feels off, chances are it is. And then the next step to that is, okay, we need to solution seek. There are two things that need to happen here. One is, where is my responsibility in this? Where can I take back control? Because I would say about 99.9% of the time, you are in a position of control in some way, shape, or form. If not control over the situation, control over your reaction to the situation. Be that in self-awareness, reflection time, and then action, but just knowing what that is. And we come back to knowing again. And confidence comes from knowing. So if we think about shoelaces, right? The first time you went to tie a shoelace, did you know what to do? No. Did you feel confident? No. Did you feel silly trying to do it? Yes. Did you feel frustrated? Yes. 100 times. So you've tied your shoelace 100 times. Do you know what to do? Yes. Do you feel confident to tie a shoelace? Yes. If somebody asked you to tie a shoelace real quick, could you do it? Yes. How do you feel confident? Because you've allowed yourself to do it. You've listened to yourself. You've allowed yourself to get it wrong. You've allowed yourself to F it up so many times that now it just comes second nature. That's what confidence is. So confidence in entering a room, confidence when having a conversation, just comes from this. It comes from knowing yourself. And I think the more that we come back to that, the better decisions and choices we can make in all aspects of our life. Know what your boundaries are. And when you know what they are, you can articulate them. Know what you're going to say no to, because it's easy to do when you know why. Like, so when people ask me now, I've got a really busy diary. Danny, do you have 5 minutes? Can I pick your brain about speaking? I'm really sorry. Go and check these resources out. If you want to learn with me, then absolutely, yes, you can, or you can pay for my time. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, and there's different resources that I've made so that I can manage the boundaries. I've written books. I've got social media with lots of tips on it. So I don't have 5 minutes for people to pick my brain anymore. So that has to be a no to protect myself and protect my time. So understanding and knowing what are your hard yeses as well as your hard no's, and you can articulate them. You can create the life through knowing. And I think that through knowing and listening to yourself breeds confidence. Where do you feel these things in your body? Like, if you're walking into a room and you're feeling in your gut, like, this isn't good, this doesn't feel good. We need to understand, we need to know, why don't we feel safe? Is it just a psychological thing that we need to work through? Is it a trauma-based thing that we need to work through? Is it that those people in the room are not safe people and you don't need to walk into that room? So again, it's this expansion on understanding what knowing is for ourselves, I think, is one of the most important things that I've learned.
I have nothing else to add to this. Can you believe that? No, but really, I think it's what you just shared. It's a very good reminder, and it's a very good advice, especially because we live in a time where confidence looks like, you know, something you can just put on and is everyone, you say, like, you don't just, for me, what is important is, like, you go, you see social media, you go, you read about all these confident leaders, entrepreneurs, yeah. You see the surface. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, because then you don't actually know unless they tell you what yeah. they are going through. And projecting that, I think, has a very bad effect.
It's dangerous. It's dangerous.
So it's really important what you share, because we need to, I always say to myself, but also with the women I work, you know, just to keep the foot on the ground and just, you know, keep the eyes on the focus. And I also need to remind this to myself every day, like, don't look at the others, you know, just focus on stay in your lane, because sometimes we get really distracted and it looks like bling bling, like so nice, so funny. Oh, they all have it. Why I cannot have it? Because yeah. that's not real.
And that's everyone's got the struggle. You're looking at the tip of the iceberg, and the iceberg is big.
Yeah.
Like, the iceberg is huge. You see there, you only see the tiniest little bit, and there's so much going on. And for the people that are sharing that they've got it all made and they've got it all sussed and they've got it all sorted, they have not. We're all winging it. Even those that look like they know what they're doing, they still have to make it up at some point. They're still making it up in other areas. They're not getting it all right. And I think that, again, let's just relinquish this need for perfection. It's a fallacy anyway. It's not real. So if we allow ourselves to sort of get gloriously uncomfortable in our mutual imperfection and solution seek together, then there is where the magic is. That's where the magic is. It isn't in looking over your shoulder or looking to the left and the right of you saying, oh, well, this person's more successful than me. This person's turning over more money than me. They might be turning over loads of money, but what's the margin like? What are they actually taking up? What's the staff bill? What's their ad spend? Mm-hmm. They're probably not got a pot to piss in, and you don't know, because they're telling you that they're earning seven figures. Well, good for them and their seven figures. What does their real business model look like? Like, they're probably not. It's the veneer. So be aware and look after and manage your own house and know yourself. It comes back to knowing.
Exactly. And knowing your worth.
Yes.
Especially because it's already 90% of the job on confidence done. You know, like you say, know what you like, what you don't like, what is vibing with you, what you will, you know, blindly step into it because you confidently trust the people, the process, the situation. So it's really, really important. And my last question, take us back to the first one, and is, what is that you wish to stop fighting for?
It's not going to happen in my lifetime is the thing. So I would like to stop fighting for it, but it's not going to happen in this lifetime, just because the amount of work that needs doing, the joy of knowing that I'm starting the work is the joy. So I would like to stop fighting for gender-based violence. I would like to stop fighting for generational abuse and perpetuation of cycles. There's this quote by a guy called Nate Postlethwaite, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it goes something along the lines of, the cycle breakers are the ones you want to watch out for, because they're the ones that stand in front of the oncoming train of generations and say, this stops with me. What I would like to think is that I get to stand in front of the oncoming train for my particular line, for my generational line. I get to model better relationships. I get to model better work ethic and dreams and hopes and abilities for my kids, but only for my bloodline. Like, the work that I do, I can't stand in front of the train for everybody. So, but if I can help each other understand and help the wider world and the wider community understand that in their own way, they get to stand in front of the oncoming train too and say, this stops with me, and provide safe community for them to explore that. How do they become the change maker, the thought leader? How do they jump on the hill that they're quite willing to die on? And like, how are they willing to sit on the spike? How can I encourage a safe space for that? Do I wish I had to do that? No. I wish we were in a much fairer, much safer environment. I could get up to much more mischief singing and entertaining people, but there is much more important work to be done. And whilst that work is there, and I'm going to be here buzzing away.
Well, someone has to start it, no? Because change doesn't just fall from the sky, you know? Yeah. It's like, if you didn't have this food, I didn't have it, someone else that is maybe listening to us, your friends, your colleagues, never thought like, you know, actually there is something that I want to change and I want to make that happen, then, you know, we might not collect the fruit of what we're fighting for today. But as you say, we need to stand in front of that train because behind us, there are other 100,000 million of women that they wish to fight for that. So we need to keep going.
We're standing on the shoulders of giants. They've paved the way for us to be able to do this work now, to have these conversations. And it's our job to be the giants that our next generation is going to stand on the shoulders of. We're planting seeds in a garden that we're not going to see the flowers of, but we know. And what joy it is to know that we get to plant those seeds, what joy it is. And yes, I'm sad that we don't get to see all of the flowers, but I get to see some of them along the way. I get to see the germination. I get to see the light bulbs. And that, you know, what an honor, what a blessing.
And I think it's even more important than actually see the final change happening. But, you know, for you to just put the seeds there, I think it's what give us the strength as well to, you know, keep pushing.
Yeah. And the more we festoon, the quicker it happens. So the more we have these conversations,
the better it is for all of us.
Yeah, that's the one.
For all the bees.
For all of them.
Well, Dani, it was a really, really a pleasure to have you here today. Is there any final thoughts or project or anything that you want to share with who is listening to us today?
For anybody that's listening that wants to kind of know more about the Flying Away Foundation, you can go to flyingaway.org.uk and find out more information there. And there's an event that I run twice a year called Be Inspired. It's in the northwest of England in Manchester at Old Trafford, where we share these ideas, where people share their stories, their TEDx style talks. It's an incredible entrepreneurial community, and you are welcome to grab yourself a ticket and come along. IamTheQueenBee.co.uk.
Amazing. Thank you again, Dani, and have a lovely evening.
Thank you for having me.
If this was your first time listening to When Power Podcast, thank you for taking the time. You can find us on Podbean and Spotify. Subscribe to our newsletter on whenpower.co and keep up to date with all the future projects on all our social media at WenPowerUK. Thank you to all the women out there that are following and supporting WenPower. I will continue to bring to you powerful, inspiring, and positive stories from all over the world. Don't forget, together we empower women. This is Ilaria for WenPower Podcast. Until next time.